Now, the topic is sex-related matters, and as you are aware, it is something which takes up a lot of the time of our courts. Our first presenter is Justin Hanbury. Justin has been at the bar now about 15 years. He has a practice which takes him across all of the Victorian jurisdictions, from the Supreme Court to the Magistrates Court, and in covering those jurisdictions, naturally he has regularly appeared in matters involving sex offences. Also, Justin has a practice which covers quasi-crime areas such as tribunals, coronial inquests and OH&S matters. So please welcome Justin Hanbury.
Thanks, everyone. There's no doubt that in the last few years, the prevalence and proportion of sex trials as a percentage of those matters that are before the courts has increased. And certainly in the county court, they've become an enormous proportion of trials, especially those trials that run. And anyone who's tried to get a trial on a circuit court in recent years will know that if your case doesn't involve sexual allegations, it'll be put behind a relatively long queue of cases that do. Now, there's a couple of reasons, I suspect, why this is the case. Some of those reasons you might think are signs of progress in society. One would expect that in this era that perhaps victims of sexual violence have become increasingly willing to report criminal offences than they were in decades past. No doubt the police have changed their attitude from what existed in previous times. They now treat those reports seriously, they seem to investigate them properly, and you don't seem to hear as often reports of allegations being made and then just being fobbed off or ignored. And thirdly, there's no doubt that the attitude of the OPP has become one of becoming more willing to prosecute matters, where in the past some matters might have been viewed as being too weak to prosecute. There seems to be effectively a pro-prosecution of matters attitude. Now, the prevalence of sexual related matters in our courts has also revealed a couple of other aspects about these types of matters. Interestingly, they have become and proven to be less likely to resolve to pleas of guilty than other matters by a fairly substantial rate. Now, whilst the exact reasons for this are uncertain, at one level you might think it's expected. The very nature of a sexual allegation means that it may appear on the surface to be difficult for someone to make an admission as to any type of sexual misconduct whatsoever, given the what one might perceive to be the stigma attached to that type of conviction. So whereas somebody might, for example, be able to negotiate about the amount of drugs they'd trafficked, the amount of money they'd stolen, to cross a line from being not a sex criminal to being a sex criminal is a huge line to cross, and it doesn't really have the type of qualities you might expect would encourage compromise. The other aspect too is that, of course, the penalties are severe, and certainly in relation to penalties involving offences where there's any sort of penetration alleged, jail and lengthy terms of imprisonment are the starting point, and as such the courts don't have much in their armoury in terms of offering lenient sentences to try to encourage people to plead guilty. Now, beyond that, I think there's another factor at play. That is, in sex matters, trials run because trials can be won. Criminal cases involving sexual allegations, and criminal prosecutions, I should say, involving sexual allegations, fail more often than trials involving different kinds of allegations. And I've mentioned the statistic from 2009-10 in the paper that of all the trials, sex trials that ran in that year, only 38.5 of those trials resulted in conviction. Now, ultimately, you might think that's the most powerful motivation not to plead guilty, namely, you're a good chance of winning. Why give it up? Now, knowing that these matters result in acquittals more often than other kind of matters, and understanding the reasons for that are two very different matters. If you know why there are more acquittals, you'll be able to tap into those reasons, use them in identify them and use them in any of your own cases. However, we've got a big problem in working that out. Juries never tell you why they come back with a verdict. They never tell you why they convicted. They never tell you why they acquitted. It might have been because of what you did. It might have been despite what you did. No one has ever sat down and compared the transcript of 500 different sex trials and compared one to the other and worked out, well, when somebody does A, B and C, they tend to win 47.2% of the time, but when they do A, B, C, D, E and F, they fail by that same rate. No such statistics available. So what's left then is me offering my 2 cents worth on it. This is all theory. This is me based on my own experience. It might be right, it might be wrong. You'll get a point anyway, so don't worry. Now, it's perhaps unsurprising that there is such a high acquittal rate when you actually think about the task that's facing the prosecution in prosecuting a sex case. Almost invariably, their task is to convince 12 complete strangers that another complete stranger is telling the truth. Their task is to say to 12 people, well, listen to an hour's worth of this complete stranger's evidence and send that complete stranger to jail. If you think about it in that regard and thinking about that this is an enormous question for a jury, the judge reminds them about the standard of proof and the burden of proof, it's perhaps unsurprising that when the prosecution is often so heavily reliant on a single witness, and indeed in basically every sex case, acceptance of the evidence of a single witness will be the difference between winning and losing. It's perhaps unsurprising that the prosecution's task proves too much so often. Also add to that mix that regularly the prosecution attempt that task without any assistance in the form of corroboration from eyewitnesses, often without any DNA evidence, often without any medical evidence or any other form of forensic evidence, and often in the face of direct denials from the accused. Big ask for the jury to have two people they don't know coming before them, one who says it happened, one who says it didn't, and say, well, it's good enough for me, he can go to jail. It's a big call, and perhaps unsurprising that it's one that a jury often finds very hard to make. Now, the fact that these prosecutions are difficult and the fact that the success rate is low has been well and truly identified by the legislature. And if we go back over the last few years, you can see time and again there are attempts to try to make life easier for the prosecution, to try to change that equation. I can say they haven't been successful in doing that, but there's no doubt that's what has been the intention of recent legislative changes. So think about a few I've listed here, and this isn't even a comprehensive list. The presumption that's made in favour of trials for multiple complainants being heard simultaneously. The removal in recent times of warnings that judges used to give about the dangers of convicting where there'd been a delay in making a complaint. Ever since the Evidence Act and the Criminal Procedure Act came in, the suggestion that previous representations of the complainant, so basically a complaint, can be used both to show that a complainant's acting consistently with how you might expect her to act if these are things that happened, and also the fact that she's complained to someone about being raped, for example, actually now becomes evidence in and of itself that she has been raped. They can effectively use now that piece of hearsay as evidence for the truth of its contents. And also, in a procedural sense, you no longer get the opportunity to cross-examine child complainants at a committal. Now, all those matters are clearly designed to make life harder for the defence and to try to tip the scales a little in favour of the prosecution. So I can say, as a starting point in looking at sex trials and looking at how you can be more successful at them, I'd say this: understand that these trials are very hard for the prosecution, understand why they're very hard for the prosecution, and do not make their task easier. That's the starting point. First, do no harm. Well, easy to say that, but it's important, clearly, when you're looking at an individual case, to assess, well, how hard is this task going to be for the prosecution? What have they got? Now, I've listed in a rough but I think reasonably accurate order, and obviously going to vary from case to case, as to what factors I think really significantly impact upon the probability of conviction. I think number one, clearly, is the number of complainants that are heard in a single case. Where there is one complainant being heard in the one trial, I would suggest most times that's going to be a difficult task for the prosecution to succeed. Where there are two separate complainants, especially when they can establish that there hasn't been any collusion between the two of them, or that there are two separate stories being told that have real striking similarities to them, the chances of acquittal, in my view, plummet, not just by a little bit, by a factor of 10 or something like that. But then again, 97% of statistics are made up, so I just made that one up too. But it hurts. And the reason for that, in a direct sense, when you've got two complainants, the prosecution have got more weapons in their arsenal. They can use the evidence of one complainant as what's called tendency evidence, which, if I can boil it down to this way, if there's evidence that your client's into 13-year-old girls and there's another 13-year-old girl making a complaint about him sexually interfering with her, it's easier for a jury to say, that sounds right. Coincidence evidence is also an extremely powerful weapon for the prosecution in those types of trials. And what that basically means is, if I can cut through lots and lots of cases and boil it down to a single sentence, two people telling two similar stories, if they haven't got their heads together, are probably telling the truth. That's what it comes down to. And that is an extremely powerful logic in front of a jury. Bottom line is, where you've got two separate people making similar allegations, it's much harder to suggest to a jury that lightning has struck in the same place twice and that your bloke's been unlucky on two separate occasions, having two complete liars telling the same story about him. Now, next, corroboration. Now, what I mean by corroboration is basically any evidence that supports either the core allegation that's being made by the complainant, like, for example, if there is a suggestion that there's been penetration, if there's DNA or medical evidence to support that, that really supports the core allegation. Corroboration can also go to the broader circumstances of the story and be very helpful. So, for example, if a complainant says this happened at Lake Eildon in a holiday in 1978, and you've got evidence that she was at Lake Eildon on a holiday in 1978, whilst it doesn't actually confirm the fact of the sexual allegations, it does at least support her as a witness, and when you're relying upon her credibility, that's assistance. The third factor I've mentioned, I think, is a much underrated one. That is the age and the circumstances of the complainant. Now, it's my sense that a complainant who is maybe older, with a more stable social, work, family background, is more likely to be believed than teenage complainants or very young complainants. And I think part of the logic is that the jury might think, well, why is this 40-year-old mother of three coming before us telling us about these shocking allegations? Why would she be doing that? You've removed from their considerations the concern that, well, this is just a teenager who said something silly. This is a young person lacking maturity who's made a silly comment. You've removed that from the equation. So when you're looking at the case, have a look at who's making the complaint, because this is the witness that's meant to be carrying the day for the Crown, and there are certain types of witnesses. Remember, given that the jury don't know them at all, if the starting point is that they're of a type of witness who you might think is inherently more stable, more reliable, that certainly assists. Next is one that's hard to work out before the trial, but you can get a sense of it, and that's what I'm trying to identify is what the essence of a witness is when somebody says, oh, she was a good witness. The factor I think is common with all good witnesses is that they have a capacity to make admissions against their own interest without complaint. And what I mean by that is there'll be a question put to them that on the face of it might hurt them, but if they tell the jury that without hiding it, without complaining about it, that goes a long way to assisting them and identifying them as a witness of truth. That's a devastating trait in any witness. On the other side of it, a witness who is shown to have their ego or some other sort of agenda in play by unnecessarily denying even an innocuous matter that might be viewed as being against their interests certainly goes a long way to damaging their credibility. The next factor is the response of the accused to the allegations. Now, this will define how the case is going to be run and can turn a weak prosecution case into a strong one. And what I mean by that is that it can work in two ways. Where you have an accused who denies an innocuous or makes an unnecessary denial about some broader piece of the circumstances surrounding the offence, that is going to undermine his credit. Even in circumstances where it doesn't necessarily amount to being an admission, it certainly can assist the jury in thinking, well, this person's not telling the truth. I know he's lied about X issue, even if it's not at the absolute core of the case, and that's going to hurt. The other way it can really hurt is by forcing you as a defence to run what I would call the wrong defence. So, for example, you might look at a case and think, wow, this is big chance here that this was a consensual act, and then you read the record of interview and the person's denied that anything happened. That makes it hard, because suddenly it's not just the complainant's version that is being considered, it's the unlikely version that's been put forward by your client, and that makes things much harder. I'm going to finish with just two other types of evidence that often are used by the Crown, but I think don't have any particular weight, or certainly not the weight of the other factors I've mentioned. Whether or not a complaint was made at the time, I think, is somewhat overrated. These days, because of the lack of warnings you get about delay and the fact that the directions that a jury gets about how they should be, frankly, very forgiving of any complainant who hasn't immediately told someone about their sexual assault allegation, means that the worth to the defence in making some forensic use of a delay in complaint has been really diminished, in my view, because the jury listens to the judge more than they listen to you. There's no doubt about that. And when the judge is saying, basically, don't worry about it, it doesn't really help the defence too much. On the other hand, I don't think from the prosecution perspective, the fact that someone has made a complaint at a particular time necessarily takes the matter too far. And the reason I say that is that ultimately the trial's going to be about whether you believe this witness or not, whether she's telling the truth in court, whether she was telling the truth when she reported it to the police, whether she was telling the truth when she reported it to her mother or her mate, all coming from the complainant herself. Therefore, I think the worth of it is fairly limited, and whilst legally you can apparently now use it for the truth of its allegations, I don't think that has much resonance with juries at all. And the final matter that seems to often be used that I don't think is of much use for a similar reason is what I describe as other uncharged acts alleged by the complainant. So you're charged with one rape, and also the jury gets to find out from the complainant that, well, she says it happened seven other times. Well, as long as it's all emerging from the same source, namely still the same witness, and the jury has to believe this witness, whether she says it happened once or 100 times, doesn't make it any more credible. It's still the one witness, so that doesn't really assist too much. Now, there are some things in my submission you can... submission, not in court, in my opinion, that you can do in these trials that can actually go a fair way to assisting the prosecution. And I identify these things because a lot of them are matters that you might think instinctively are good. And sometimes they are good, and sometimes they're very good. But they all have a potential downside. They all have potential pitfalls for the defence, and they can result in prosecutions being successful where otherwise they may not be. And the first one I identify is lengthy cross-examination of the complainant. Now, I don't know, maybe some people make this work, but as a starting point, as a matter of logic, have a think about what task the prosecution has. They have to prove their case by basically getting the jury to believe one witness. Now, if you were the prosecution, do you want the jury to have a greater or lesser chance to hear from that witness and listen to their evidence and get to know that witness? Of course, you would want a greater opportunity. All things being equal, if you had one judge who said, right, I'll give you 15 minutes to convince the jury with that witness, and another judge who said, I'll give you an hour, if you were the prosecution, you'd take the hour every time. Now, obviously, if you're achieving something in cross-examination, that is one thing, but as a starting point, the less time the prosecution has to present their witness before the jury, the better. Similarly, overly aggressive cross-examination of a complainant can be very destructive of the defence case. The prosecution have the task in front of them. They've got one witness they need to have the jury accept. If that witness has been harangued and has been shouted at and has been in the witness box under intense pressure, and at the end of it still says her story the same as it was at the start, I reckon as a jury you're going to be more likely to say, well, you know, I wasn't sure when she just told her story the first time, but after she'd been tested thoroughly, I'm now more readily able to accept that version of events. That's the real downside of it. And the reality is too is that despite mythology about this matter, a witness is not more likely to agree with you just because you put the question in a louder tone of voice. And in fact, they'll be less likely to agree with you because suddenly it doesn't just become about the worth of the question or the truth of the answer, it becomes an ego battle. And no one likes losing an ego battle, so the witness is much more likely to dig in and respond by repeating the allegations more stridently and more vehemently than the prosecutor could ever have dreamed possible, and certainly more than the prosecutor could ever have drawn out of the witness themselves. I've mentioned the issue of video links. Now, it's very regular now that witnesses will either have to be presented via video because they're under 18 at the time, or they will choose to do so and take up that opportunity. From a defence perspective, don't fight it. Where you have an opportunity for a witness to be physically separated from the jury and not present in the same room and be forced to give their evidence over a screen, the chances are that evidence is going to be less powerful. It's going to resonate less with a jury. The ability to translate emotion through a screen is a very rare one in our society. That's why movie stars and TV stars get paid a lot of money, because they have the capacity to do that. Most people don't. Once the prosecution put their best witness behind a screen, their case is weakened, full stop. And whilst it might certainly make life easier for the complainant, there's no doubt in my view that in legislating this to be a regular occurrence, they have legislated the comfort of complainants above a desire to achieve convictions. And that's a value judgment, I suppose, that others can make. I mentioned about asking more detail of a witness. Obviously, there's a time factor involved in that. There's also the very strong chance that witness will accommodate you with more detail, and suddenly a fairly sparse version of events might become a richly detailed and engaging version of events. If you're going to be asking questions about detail, don't just dig around presuming that a witness will eventually stuff up. You better know where you're going, because otherwise all you're doing is feeding the hungry beast that is the prosecution case. Now, the main matter, though, that I really do think is a trap in these trials, and it's a trap that you instinctively want to fall into, because it's a natural human emotion to be able to want to tell the jury a reason why this person is making up these allegations. That is just natural. You're drawn to it. In my view, though, it is a trap that almost invariably works for the prosecution when the defence fall into it, and that there are a number of reasons for this. When you are suggesting to a witness that they are motivated to lie, to motivated to make up false sexual assault allegations, what you have to be aware of is that, firstly, that is an allegation that will prove impossible to prove. If you think about it this way, no one's a mind reader. You can never really know what is going on in the mind of another person. You might know why they are doing something, but you can never really know. You might be able to guess at it from the surrounding circumstances, but ultimately the witness is going to know better than you what's in their mind. So in that regard, putting to a witness that they're making this up because of X, Y or Z reason is undoubtedly going to be denied by the witness, and once it's denied by the witness, you can't prove it, because they're the only ones that know. Good thing, though, is that the judge will tell the jury that, and the good thing, though, is that the judge will go out of their way to let the jury know they don't have to establish that a witness is lying or has a reason for lying. Second, remember, in the normal course of events, the prosecution is not able to say to the jury, why would she lie? That's not within their arsenal. That is a reversal of the onus of proof, and as such, it's disallowed. Once you go there, though, you permit the prosecution to go there as well. Maybe not go there in as explicit a way as asking why would she lie, but you're certainly inviting the jury to speculate on that topic. And unless you've got a really good answer for it, you might not like what the jury think about the answer to that question. Now, third, despite anything a judge might say about it, once you raise the issue of a motive to lie, you've shifted the focus of the trial onto less fertile ground for the defence. You've created a harder question for the jury to answer than you want them to answer. You, as defence, want the jury to answer in the affirmative the easiest question possible. And what I mean by that is, I won't say in the affirmative, I'll take that back, that you want them to answer in the way you want, the easiest question possible. Have they proven beyond reasonable doubt, based solely on the evidence in this case, that this complainant is telling the truth? Hard question. Have the defence shown that she's lying? That's an even harder question. You don't want the jury to be thinking that way. That makes life harder for the defence. And the reason for that is if you think about it, even though there might be a relatively small amount of evidence to actually support the allegations, there's almost certainly going to be almost zero evidence that the allegations didn't happen. And what I mean by that is, beyond denying an allegation, there might be absolutely nothing else that can be put before the court as positive evidence that the allegations did not occur. Why would you want to highlight that? Why would you want to shift the focus onto that? Now, I'll quickly go through what I say, though, are the factors I think that are crucial if you are going to raise motive to lie. Because, of course, there are times when it's appropriate to raise it. And there are, though, however, certain key factors that have to be met before it's of any worth to your case whatsoever. First one's timing. If you're going to be suggesting to the witness they've got a motive to lie, it has to have been in existence at the time they first complained about the matter. It is of absolutely no use if it emerged subsequently. So, for example, witness says these things happened to me back on the 1st of January. In February, they go and see a lawyer and the lawyer says, well, you might be able to launch a civil claim here. Might be an interesting little tidbit, but it doesn't really help you too much because it doesn't explain why this person has made this allegation in the first place. The nature of the motive, I think, is crucial as well. Emotional motives are worth far, far more, in my view, than financial ones. Hatred, jealousy, anger. They're the type of things that might conceivably induce someone to make a false allegation, might conceivably and spontaneously induce a statement that is hurtful to another person. Compare that with how a financial motive apparently plays out. Person sits around and says, right, oh, I've really got to make some money. I really need money badly. What's the best way I can come up with to make money? I know. I'll run to the police and say that my stepfather raped me. That's going to be great because I'll then have to go to the police. I'll then have to go to court. I'll get cross-examined about this. Case will come to court in about 2 years. After that, I might be up for... was it about $5,000's worth of crimes comp money? You know what? Go rob a bank. Much easier. As an indictable offence committed to make money, drug trafficking and armed robbery are much quicker, much easier, and much more successful than making up false sexual assault allegations. Now, if you don't think the jury, 12 people with combined brain power, greater than any individual who can go into court, and I don't care how smart that person is. If you don't think a jury can suss onto that fairly quickly, you're wrong. Financial motives are extremely problematic, in my view, and in all but the rarest cases should be avoided at all costs. Now, I'll just say quickly to finish my other final sense about these cases is that you should only call your client to give evidence where it is unavoidable. And what I mean by that is it's unavoidable when calling your client is the only way of putting before the jury a piece of evidence that you need to run your defence properly. If someone's done a no-comment record of interview, but they want to run consent as a defence, well, clearly they're going to have to get in the witness box and put some consent version before the jury. If they want to run alibi, but they haven't said that in their record of interview, or if at no stage have they denied on tape that the allegations occurred, you might have to do it then. But apart from that, I disagree with this notion that, well, juries expect to hear from the person. Juries are exceptionally good at listening to what the judge tells them to do and following those directions. I'm not cynical at all about their ability to do that. And in my view, I think you're selling them short if you think that they're not going to be capable of doing that unless they hear from an accused. There are huge risks in calling an accused to give evidence, even if nothing much occurs in cross-examination. What you're doing is shifting the whole focus of the trial away from, have they proven that the complainant's telling the truth, to, what do you reckon about the accused? Now, your accused might be a fantastic witness, but I'm tipping in most cases this will be their debut effort in the witness box. You know, some people have come into the test side and made a ton in their first innings, but other people go out first ball. So I would say be very, very careful about that and apply the same test of that you would if you're asking a question in cross-examination of a witness. Do you have to do it? And if not, don't. Now, thanks, ladies and gentlemen. It's 8:10 now, but I might be around later on if there's any questions too. So thanks very much.